Well, we talk a lot about podcasting and we talk about the afterlife on this program. Up next, Mike Dorsey, Scott Michaels joins us as we talk about Dearly Departed. They've got a podcast out that really highlights this. They're both next on Coast to Coast AM. But first, listen to their podcast.
Because I met Mark Lindsay from Paul Revere and the Raiders a few years ago. And Mark Lindsay lived on Cielo Drive with Terry Melcher, the producer, who knew Manson.
Yeah.
That's why Manson knew the house. Then Mark Lindsay moved out. Candace Bergen moved in. Then they both moved out. And that's when Sharon and Roman moved in. But Mark Lindsay told me that he and Terry Melcher composed Him or Me and Good Times on the piano in the room. And the house is furnished.
Yeah.
So the same couch that Terry Melcher was sitting on is the same sofa that Sharon Tate was murdered on.
Right.
And so the piano was just a few feet from that. And those two amazingly cool songs ended up, you know, coming out of an instrument that was just a few feet away from one of the most horrific crimes in American history. So it's sort of a weird pop culture reference. And that's exactly the kind of stuff he grooved on, you know. He wanted to know what the sheet music was on the piano.
Straight Shooter.
So, yeah, Straight Shooter and Pomp and Circumstance.
Yeah, but then the two songs you told him about ended up in the trailer.
Yeah.
And then how did you feel when you saw that?
I mean, it's a kick in the pants. I mean, you're like, I know that came from me. You know, I do.
So we're going to be back with Mike Dorsey and Scott Michaels as we talk about their Dearly Departed podcast and some of the incredible things and stories they have covered or uncovered on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. George Norrie with you. Let me introduce you to two special guests. First, Scott Michaels, serving as the inspiration for the Eternal Darkness tour on season one of the American Horror Story, and was a historical consultant for Quentin Tarantino for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He is an icon in the world of Hollywood death. In 1994, he helmed L.A.'s infamous Graveline Tours, driving tourists around Hollywood in a funeral hearse. I may have seen him. He also launched his popular celebrity website, findtodeath.com, which chronicles the last days of celebrities' lives. In 2005, he launched his own Hollywood tour company, Dearly Departed Tours, which quickly became the authoritative celebrity death source and is the founder of the Dearly Departed podcast with co-host Mike Dorsey. First of all, let's say hi to Scott. Scott, welcome to the program.
George, what an intro. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm looking forward to this, and let me bring Mike in. Mike Dorsey is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, editor, television producer. He's been a frequent collaborator with Dearly Departed podcast host Scott Michaels for more than a decade. Mike made the 2015 crime documentary Murder Rap Inside the Biggie and Tupac Murders, which solves the murders of Biggie and Tupac. Most recently, he was the producer and editor of the paranormal documentary Demon House, starring Zach Bagans from Ghost Adventures. And with Scott Michaels, Mike produced the Manson family documentary The 6 Degrees of Helter Skelter, which BuzzFeed readers named the 4th scariest documentary ever. Here's Mike Dorsey. Hey, Michael.
Hello, thank you.
Looking forward to this, too. And did Biggie and Tupac... Some keep saying that Tupac is still alive. Do you keep hearing that story?
All the time. It's mainly just in the tabloids that are looking for clicks. It's pretty irrefutable that he died.
Yeah, I think so, too. Tragedy in Las Vegas.
Sure, but he's an iconic figure, and he has a very passionate fan base. So, you know, kind of like with Elvis, people don't want to let it go and let him go. So I get why people want to believe he's still alive.
So both your mics will be open, so feel free to jump in at any time. But Scott, what got you to start the Dearly Departed podcast?
Well, Mike and I have been friends and collaborators, as you said, for about 10 years. And sort of, you know, everyone else was doing it. We had some great stories that haven't been told. Our own sort of slant on Hollywood has really never been touched upon. And we just figured, well, we'll give it a shot, and people seem to respond to it. And we enjoy it, actually. It's a lot of fun.
How often are you doing the show?
Currently? Not as often as we'd like to. Probably we put together about one every about 2 weeks is how we launch about one new one every couple of weeks.
And for people who want to hear it, how do they find it?
It is on, they can go to dearlydepartedpod.com, and then they can look up Dearly Departed Podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and you can find us on Facebook.
Okay, let's have you guys get more shows to producer Tom. We'll see what we can do for you on the iHeartRadio podcasting.
That'd be great.
That would be terrific. Thank you, George.
It's a great topic indeed. The Hollywood is a great place for these strange and unusual deaths. And you, Scott, and you, Mike, you're right in the middle of all of it, aren't you?
Right in the thick of it, yeah. Yeah, I sort of embrace it. A lot of people run from the subject, but that's sort of where we run to. And it's the go-to story for me. I love the Hollywood deaths.
Scott, did you find when you started the Dearly Departed tours that there was a great audience for this?
Well, there's certainly a culty audience to it. You know, we've all sort of. Well, it's funny, when I started doing this tour or I started doing this business, it was back when, you know, people were buying their true crime magazines and sort of tucking them in the back of their grocery bags so no one would see. And now you know, there are 24-hour cable networks devoted strictly to the subject matter. So people have come out of the closet, so to speak, you know, and I was sort of at the forefront of that, most definitely. And people have sort of, well, now the mainstream has jumped on my bandwagon, you know.
That's right.
It's become very commonplace now.
I was just given the address of Marilyn Monroe's house that she was in when she died. I don't even know if it's still around, but do you know anything about that? It was in Brentwood somewhere.
05 Fifth Helena Drive. Sure, it's still there.
It's still there?
Yeah.
Is it eerie when you drive by these places and just kind of stare at the house? Let me tell you why. I go to Denver every month to do our Beyond Belief television show. And in Boulder, of course, that's where JonBenet Ramsey, the poor little girl, was killed. Mm-hmm. And the driver said, look, you know, before I get you to the TV studio, we're going right by the JonBenet Ramsey house. I want to show it to you. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, do I want to see the house? And he said, look, you're in the news business. You need to see this. And he just says, I'm going to ask you a question afterwards. I said, okay, this is my driver. And he drives me up by the house, and I look at it, and you get the weirdest sensation looking at that house, visualizing and trying to picture the tragedy that happened years before. Do people get that feeling when you take them on tours and they look at these places?
Well, I try to encourage that feeling, actually, because that's what puts a human spin on that. When you're looking at that house, the Ramsey house in Boulder, you're trying to think of imagine the things that those walls echoed, you know, the things that home sort of contains. And it's been a fascination for so many people for so long. So, for instance, on my tour, if we're passing the Janis Joplin Hotel, you know, where she passed away, I can point out her room, and people sort of, you know, are fascinated with that. But if you add in that human aspect of playing her music and then looking at that room, that's the emotional impact. That's the part that I really, that's what I go for, because it makes these people into real stories, real humans, not just, you know, record albums or photographs. You could realize the history that happened right there.
Are these places haunted?
Well, I would say some of them are, most definitely. I think so. I think that there are some things, some people just aren't ready to move on. And I do believe that some of these people do hang around. Yeah, definitely.
Interesting. And Mike, when you have worked on the documentary end of a lot of this, of course, have you found it to be strange and unusual on some of these cases?
Yeah, I grew up in a law enforcement family, so I kind of grew up hearing about stories about the strange and unusual
sure.
things people do to each other. But for me, a lot of times I'm up editing late at night. And so when it's 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning and you're in a dark room and the city is asleep and I'm editing something like Demon House, you kind of creep yourself out in a way. You start thinking that you're hearing things or seeing things out of the corner of your eyes. So yeah, it can get, when you're kind of in this world for a long time, it kind of can get to you a little bit.
With your documentary about the Manson family with the 6 degrees of Helter Skelter, what made it one of the 4th most scariest documentaries, according to BuzzFeed readers?
Well, we took audiences to the locations where things happened.
Aha.
Uh-huh. And it's interesting. We didn't really focus on the killers so much because they've been, idolized in a way by society and kind of held up, a lot of the focus is always on them. And so we focus more on the victims and where the victims lived and all. When I think we went to 40 different locations tied to the crimes. And I think that it was once we set it up, and then once you get into the murders, you're kind of primed for it. And we had video footage from inside the house in Cielo Drive before it was torn down that we used with crime scene photos and everything. And it really put you there. And we had, some of the Manson recordings, music recordings that they had, we got permission to use. So I think it's just it's the real horror of it. It's a horror film, but it actually happened.
Right. We tried to stay away from the how could this have happened, the homecoming princess turned murderer. We really didn't do any of that stuff. We were very victim-oriented, and it was more like this is where it happened and this is exactly what happened, as opposed to, the theoretical stuff. And that actually, the horror of the real incident is horrifying enough without adding in all that other business, because we are very... We focus on the victims and what they went through, as opposed to, the killers' lives.
A couple of years ago, I played the recording of Charlie Manson's original audition tape, musical audition tape that he gave to the Beach Boys, hoping that he was going to become one of them. And they, of course, rejected him. And the Beach Boys' original founder and agent, Russ Regan, who's not with us anymore, I had a copy of the tape to let us play and listen to. We could not keep it. But it was strange hearing Charlie Manson do what he did. But after they rejected him, he flipped out, and look what happened.
Right. Yeah, that certainly added to the things that were going on in his head at that time. I mean, Manson, the thing about him, he wasn't terrible. He wasn't a bad musician. He wasn't a bad songwriter. He wasn't terrific either, but he was as good as he was not good, and so I can understand how he had some cachet back then. He could have done okay. There were a lot of people that were worse than him that got record deals, and him by him being sort of shunned by the Beach Boys, well, that did not set well with him, certainly.
Let's talk about some of the favorite LA-based murders and why they're so popular still at this point. Of course, we got to start with Sharon Tate. A tragedy, no doubt, but that's way up on the list, isn't it?
That's my go-to story. I mean, that has been my obsession for decades. I just find that case so fascinating, because up until that night of the Tate murders, you thought you were safe in your own bed, and people weren't anymore. Yeah, Abigail Folger was literally in bed reading a book, wearing a nightgown in bed, and within 30 minutes, she was on the front lawn with 28 stab wounds. And it was unsolved for 4 months, so it changed everyone's comfort level. You were no longer safe in your own house, in your own bed. And it had everything, rock stars and movie stars and just drama. And it was a fascinating story, and it's almost unreal. It's almost like it is a movie.
Indeed. What about Frank Salatry?
Yeah, Frank Salatry. He was a producer. He made some blaxploitation films in the 70s. Blackenstein was one of them. A kind of a knockoff of Blackula. And he lived in a couple of Bela Lugosi's old homes. And Frank, he actually, one of his paintings is in my shop right now in my museum that his niece gifted me. But Frank was brutally murdered in his home up in the Hollywood Hills, which is bizarrely still an unsolved crime. But the fact that he was immersed in these horror movies and immersed in Bela Lugosi's life and history makes him a really interesting case that has never really been looked at seriously by anyone. It still sits there in the unsolved case file.
And would you highlight cases like this in the podcast, the Dearly Departed podcast?
Definitely. Yeah, it's the thing. It's the odd little stories about people that you maybe forgot. But what? For instance, there's a woman by the name of Susan Cabot. She's a film called The Wasp Woman. and you know, that kind of went nowhere. You know, she was a pretty lady, a beautiful actress, we'll say, and she had some interesting romances, and she had a child, and they lived in Sherman Oaks, and she wasn't working so much anymore. But one day her son murdered her with a barbell.
Oh, jeez.
And bludgeoned her to death and hid the barbell in a box of Tide detergent, then called the police claiming ninjas killed his mother. And her son, Timothy, was actually a medically defined dwarf, and he got away with the crime. He was acquitted because he was on experimental growth hormones. So there's a story for you. And
that's episode 3, I think, of our show.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Episode 2 or 3, yeah.
The Wasp, what was she? Was a one-time wonder in the movies?
Yeah, but she also, Timothy Roman Scott, who was her son, was it was rumored to be, he was with her affair with King Hussein of Jordan. So it gets weirder and weirder.
And there's the CIA potential involvement in all of that and everything. It's a really bizarre story.
And so her death makes her, you know, interesting to me. Those are the kind of interesting stories that I kind of gravitate towards, the things you didn't know about the things you maybe thought you knew everything about. There's a story, you know, and those are the ones that pique our interest.
What was the silent movie theater murder? What was that?
Well, it was a fascinating story. There was literally a silent movie theater on Fairfax near here in Hollywood. And a husband and wife opened it in the 40s. They were showing exclusively silent films. This is a place where Chaplin and Clara Bow would go to see their own films. And it was a wonderful place. Well, the husband and wife who opened it preserved silent films. Ironically, he passed away from cancer from the fumes from the chemicals that he used to preserve the films. And his wife had closed the place up. And then a young student from across the street sort of befriended her by the name of Lawrence Austin and persuaded her to let him operate the theater. So they reopened it with Mr. Austin at the helm. And Mr. Austin had a boyfriend that ultimately became the projectionist. And he was in his 60s, and he loved the place. He would introduce the films. He would rip the tickets and sell the tickets. And one day during the film was called Sunrise, shortly after the film began, a young man came from the theater and asked the candy counter girl if they had advanced tickets for sale. She pointed him to Mr. Austin at the box office, to which he walked up and shot him in the face and killed him instantly.
Jeez.
And took off running through the theater out the back way. So the crime was unsolved for the longest time, and they had, you know, fundraisers and GoFundMes. It wasn't called GoFundMes back then, but to bury Mr. Austin and to do tributes for Mr. Austin. And it was a big deal. And people from L.A. were outraged and disgusted because of this wonderful situation that this wonderful sort of landmark was now in questionable future. And it turned out, well, the boyfriend had hired this young man to kill his Mr. Austin and the candy counter girl so he would inherit the movie theater.
Gosh.
And it's a great story. And also, Mr. Austin, it does still haunt that theater. He is still most definitely hanging around in that theater.
And we're going to come back and talk more about some paranormal experiences you've both had. We'll also talk about the curse of Benedict Canyon. And, Scott, I understand you've got a collection of strange artifacts. Let's have you explain those when we come back as well. Mike Dorsey, Scott Michaels, our special guest. We'll take some of your haunted questions next hour with both of them. Their website, dearlydepartedpod.com. That's where you can listen to their podcast. DearlyDepartedPod.com that we have linked up for you at CoastToCoastAM.com. So we'll be back in a moment. Those of you calling, hang with us a little bit. We're going to take calls at the top of the hour. We'll be back. And welcome back. George Norrie with you, along with two special guests, Scott Michaels, Mike Dorsey. We're talking about their Dearly Departed podcast and some fascinating stories of Hollywood, of people who have passed on. We will take your calls with both of them next hour, so get ready for that. Scott and Mike, let's talk more about some of these other based situations. The Curse of Benedict Canyon, what happened there?
Well, Benedict is most famous because of the Tate murders, the whole Manson thing. But in my years that I've been studying these incidents around Los Angeles, I put together a list of all the things that have happened at Benedict Canyon. There are like four canyon roads that'll take you from Los Angeles over Mulholland Drive to the San Fernando Valley. There's Laurel Canyon and Benedict Canyon and the Coldwater. So anyway, Benedict is one of those main arteries. But from the very bottom of it, where the Beverly Hills Hotel is, which is where the actor Peter Finch died, about a block up is where Thomas Ince lived. And Thomas Ince died mysteriously, they say, on William Randolph Hearst's yacht. Going all the way up Benedict Canyon, I can name so many people that have lived on Benedict Canyon that have died mysteriously. Like, for instance, John Ritter. He lived on Benedict Canyon Boulevard when he died.
That was a sad story.
Extremely sad and so sudden. And right across the street was where Elizabeth Montgomery passed away. Now, just a little bit further up the road, George Reeves, Superman, in 1959, stopped by a speeding bullet to the head. Just a couple of doors down from him was Susan Berman, which is that the Jinx murder that he's going on trial for now. Jay Sebring, who was murdered along with Sharon Tate, also lived in Benedict Canyon in the very house that Jean Harlow's husband, Paul Byrne, killed himself in. Rudolph Valentino lived in Benedict Canyon. Brandon Lee lived on Benedict Canyon Boulevard. So all the way up from Sunset all the way to Mulholland, there are at least 25 famous people that have died mysteriously in Benedict. And I'm sure there are lots more that aren't famous that have met their same fate.
Why is that area so haunted? I mean, what do you think may have happened way back to make this start?
Well, my theory is that it is ancient Indian burial ground. It's probably not a PC way to put it anymore, but that's my gut feeling. All of Los Angeles used to be their territory. And I do believe that it was a main artery going across to the valley back then. And probably some people died along the way. Some people think there's some sort of geomagnetic, anomaly underneath the canyon too that makes people behave curiously. But that doesn't explain the people that have passed away in other places. But it's just an odd concentration, because just a mile away is Laurel Canyon, and Laurel is where all the wonderful, the Doors and the Mamas and the Papas and all that business. That all happened very close by. But Benedict has got a real sinister vibe to it, and I never really understood why that hasn't been explored more.
You've been collecting some strange artifacts. Tell us about them.
Well, we do have an artifact museum now.
Really?
We started as a tour, and now we have a proper museum. And I've been collecting these odd artifacts from notorious locations since I was a kid. And for instance, I have a pool from a pool tile from the pool that Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones passed away in. I have a piece of the floor that Bobby Kennedy landed on when he was shot in the Ambassador Hotel. I have the bed that Rock Hudson died in. So it's gone on to bigger things.
Not necessarily just haunted things.
Right. I mean, these are things that are involved with people. For instance, now one thing I could probably reassemble Sharon Tate's fireplace in my shop, and that those stones definitely carry some energy, most definitely. We try really hard to maintain the things we have in our shop, because there's lots of collective awful vibes, and so we do lots of we do blessings. We use sage, we use salt, and all sorts of different things.
Sure.
But these particular stones need extra care, because there are some real negativity involved with these things. And I've had many psychic mediums come in and go straight for them, saying, "What's that?" We have some uncomfortable artifacts. Probably the biggest is the 1966 Buick Electra that Jane Mansfield was killed in. We do have that in our shop.
Oh, my God. I remember that as a kid. Didn't she have her head cut off or something, didn't she?
Yeah. Yeah, the top of her head actually was sheared off.
Oh.
Helped. It was they went under a truck going about 70. The truck was going about 30. And at that point, they did not have one of those orange and white striped bars below the rear of the truck. It sits 18 inches off the surface of the road to stop cars from going underneath trucks.
Oh.
And that is nicknamed the Mansfield Bar because that became a law because of this accident.
Was that a driver's problem on their part?
Yes. He was sober. He was well-rested, but he was distracted. And it was all understandable what had happened. It was, but it was the driver's error.
And he was a young driver, too, I think, right? He was a teenager?
Yeah, he was 19. Yeah. So three people were killed in the front seat. The three children, one who is Mariska Hargitay from Law & Order, mm-hmm. She was 3 years old, in the back seat. The three children survived, but the three in front were killed instantly.
What a horrible story. And John Zaffis, have you heard his name? He is an expert in haunted attached pieces, artifacts, and things like that.
He'd have a field day at our place.
Oh, my gosh. So you have some that are cursed, you think?
Oh, yeah, I do think so. Well, cursed is a strong word to use. I would say there are attachments to them.
Sure.
There are curses that supposedly exist, like Jane Mansfield was supposedly cursed, or actually her boyfriend, Sam Brody, was cursed by Anton LaVey, who founded the Church of Satan.
He was a Satanist, that's right.
Right, and he invented the whole Church of Satan business, and he was a showman, much like Jane Mansfield was a showwoman. And they sort of fed off of each other. They'd both do anything for an inch of column space. And unfortunately, Jane will be forever associated with LaVey because of this. But he took credit for the accident because he says that he cursed her boyfriend, Sam Brody, who was trying to extract LaVey from Jane's life.
Interesting. Now, some of the creepy places around Hollywood, we've talked about a few, but tell me about the L.A. County Morgue.
Oh, man. We've been in there a few times. We have a friend of ours who used to be their director of operations, Craig. And we got in when we filmed the 6 degrees of Helter Skelter. And, you know, we've both stood inside the crypt with, you know, upwards of maybe 100 bodies around us. And it's not, they aren't in black body bags like what you would see on TV. They're loosely wrapped in clear plastic. So, you know, and some of them are just out in the open.
Oh, my God.
So it really is. It takes a lot of nerve to cross that threshold from the hallway into the crypt when that door slides open. And to see, I mean, it's, you know, it's not something you see every day unless you work in a morgue. So just being in the building is creepy enough. But when you go into that room, it's a real house. It's a real life house of horrors.
It really is, and what compounds the whole thing, I mean, it's visually enough, it's disturbing, and this is going to be a bit graphic, and I apologize if it's too much, but it's the smell. It is the smell that really kicks you in the face. It's just like that.
Regardless of what they've tried to do, you can't stop that.
Right. I used to think it was, you know, it was chemicals, and no, it's not chemicals.
And it's a heavily ventilated, and, you know, there's constantly people scrubbing the hallways and everything. But you can't overcome.
But you can't avoid it, and that's I think something you can't shake. And one time, Mike and I were shooting in one of the areas where the autopsies were taking place, and one of the poor kids on the I've never seen anybody physically turn green before. This poor kid was going to pass out. It takes a strong stomach to be able to sit there and look at that objectively, but this poor kid just was a little bit too much for him.
And then that night we took him up Cielo Drive because it was the anniversary of the Manson murders, the Tate murders.
You can't say it was a boring shoot for them.
Now, I bet you've come across some very weird and strange encounters as well, haven't you?
Paranormal-wise, sure. I've come up with a couple of interesting incidents here and there. Actually, some of them were associated with the Tate fireplace bricks. Because I had all these things before I opened my museum. I had so many things in my home, and I never really didn't think anything of it. You know, I just had these things in a cabinet, and I kept them all here. Well, I had this large box of stones from the Tate fireplace in my laundry room. And twice over the, you know, at the beginning of when I moved into my apartment, I saw somebody standing in the doorway of my bedroom twice, you know, full figure of a man, just like a shadow, looking at me and then just turning and walking into the laundry room. And it took me the longest time to put that together, that it was it had something to do with those stones. And when I got them out of my home, those sort of apparitions stopped happening. But I had a dog that would react to those things too. So I do think that some of these things have a lot of vibes attached to them, most definitely.
What is it about the unusual, the paranormal, that gets so many people interested, fascinated? You've got tours now. Why did people really want this?
Well, I think it's still untapped, you know, territory. It's like death. That's the one question that really nobody can positively answer. And when it comes to celebrities and the paranormal, and sometimes people don't want to let the celebrities go, so they're trying to constantly, remember when your kids used to do seances and things like that, try to contact Mae West or Marilyn Monroe or whichever it was. It was something that, you know, sort of a way of mourning famous people by wanting them around. James Dean was another one that people just didn't want to let go.
That's right.
So I think that that's part of the reason, part of the attraction of the famous ghost. But just, you know, paranormal has become such a phenomenal.
I think people are just starting to let go of Elvis, as a matter of fact, after all these years. I mean, these stories that, hey, what do you think of stories where people die, but people seem to think they're still alive somewhere, that they faked their death?
Well, there's certainly a lot of ammunition for those stories, you know, and people that claim they have sightings. And I think the most convincing one would be the Jim Morrison one, or even Andy Kaufman. He's another one that people say are still around, that if anyone was going to do it, they would be the ones to do it. You know, but Jim went so far as to, you know, say, to make an anagram of his own name and say he was going to live on that name, Mojo Rising. So, you know, mysterious death, unaccounted for bodies. I think that there's a lot of ammunition for that sort of thing.
A couple of years ago, I had two of the remaining Doors in the studio, Ray Manzarek and Robbie Krieger.
Wow.
Ray has since died. But yeah, I asked them specifically. I said, do you think Jim Morrison faked his death? Is he still alive? And they said that he did not fake his death. He died when they said he died. He's not around now. And both of them felt that. But, God, I wanted them to say, we know where he is. He just fell off and didn't want to do it anymore.
Well, and the thing, you know, I'm still convinced, but I still think there's a possibility of Michael Jackson still being around. You know, but like Princess Diana is another one. People are taken away so suddenly that you don't want to let go. And therefore, you know, you keep that maybe fabricating more of a life for them. I don't know. But it just seems like so shocking and so likely, because Michael Jackson did disappear for so long, you know, to another country and sort of lived incognito. So it just seemed like a real possibility.
What is it about these great talent like Prince, Michael Jackson, Whitney Houston, you know, great performers who just die too early?
I think a lot of it has to do with boredom, really. You know, when you're creating something like that, like, for instance, you put together a record album with, I don't know, say 15 tracks on it, that is something that we're going to enjoy for years and years and years. But that's a representative of a year or so's work for that one particular person, and they'll be touring on that very same work for the next couple of years. So there's not a lot of creative things flowing. It's like movies. When people are working in movies, you're sitting around for 13 hours out of the day, maybe working for one of them. So it leaves a lot of time, and people are just bored, and they just self-medicate to relieve the boredom. And I really do think that that has a lot to do with people dying, you know, of accidental overdoses, just being bored to death, really.
What kind of films are you working on these days, Mike?
Well, we're working now. I think we just passed the 10-year anniversary of our Six Degrees of Helter Skelter documentary coming out, and we just got the rights back. So we are, you know, kind of tooling around with that and kind of updating it with new information. And then I'm always developing new projects. So it's a constant. You're either developing something new or you're working on something new. So all mainly crime-based subject matter.
Super.
My passion.
Now, when you give the tours, Scott, you know, I've seen tour buses go by, people sitting there looking at houses and stuff. Is that what they're like?
Well, I suppose so. I mean, you know, we're like a Starz Homes tour. We just do a different spin on it, where 90% of the tour companies go straight west towards Beverly Hills and the Hollywood Hills. We go straight east to the Black Dahlia and Bela Lugosi.
Yeah.
And so we are sort of off the beaten track. There is still an element of, you know, oohing and aahing over celebrities, but they're not over their hedges hoping to get a glimpse of them. It's sort of looking at the history of it. That's what we take people to the news, be it older stars like Mae West or Bella, or, you know, we do the Whitney Houston, Michael Jackson thing too. We have a tour that's devoted solely to the Tate LaBianca murders called the Helter Skelter Tour. That's 4 hours, just that story. And we have a haunted walking tour of Hollywood too. So we have a whole lot of different things going on, and people from, you know, that we have a good reputation, and people hear about us or read about us, and I'm really proud of that we have the reputation that we do have.
Do you believe that the Tate LaBianca murders are the big drawing card, basically?
This year, certainly, because of all the attention that we've gotten because of my work with Tarantino and the 50th anniversary of the film coming out. And, you know, there was a time where I thought, oh, once the principal people are all gone from this case, and a lot of them are, but some of the killers are still around, I figured once they all pass away, that'll be the end of it. But Tarantino just made everybody infamous.
He sure did. We're going to take calls with both of you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.